From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Some harsh words between the U.S. and Russia after Moscow accused Washington of sending a reconnaissance plane over the Baltic Sea speeding towards Russia's borders. Russia's military responded to claims by the U.S. European Command Sunday that a Russian jet had made aggressive maneuvers near a U.S. reconnaissance plane over the Baltic Sea, a second incident in the region between the two countries within the past week. The latest incident occurred Thursday, U.S. European Command spokesperson Danny Hernandez said, replying to a question from CNN, saying that a Russian Su-27 fighter had, quote, performed erratic and aggressive maneuvers, closed quote, flying within 50 feet of a U.S. RC-135 aircraft. The U.S. protested to Moscow, Hernandez said. Moscow, in turn, said Washington's claim was, quote, running counter to reality, closed quote, saying that its air defenses had to scramble a fighter jet after detecting a high-speed, unidentified object over the Baltic heading towards its borders. Igor Konashenkov, a spokesperson for Russia's defense ministry, said in a statement that after making, quote, visual contact, closed quote, with the Russian Su-27, the U.S. plane changed its course and pulled away from Russia's borders. That incident occurred just 2 days after two Russian Su-24 bombers buzzed the U.S. guided missile destroyer Donald Cook in the Baltic Sea Tuesday, simulating attack passes that one U.S. military official described as among the most aggressive interactions between the two countries in recent memory. A meeting between major oil-producing countries in the Qatari capital Doha on a deal to cap production ended without agreement. The event was attended by OPEC and non-OPEC producers. Qatar's energy minister said the participants needed more time for consultation in order to reach agreement.
We debated the freeze from all aspects and what could that result. And the meeting concluded that we all need time for further consultation from now till June meeting in OPEC. All participating countries will consult among themselves and with others. The meeting recognized that the oil market at the moment is relatively healthier than what it was February. And we think that the fundamentals of the market is generally improving. The pressure we were subjected to is less as fundamentals are improving now, and oil is heading the right direction. How long it will balance itself, we are yet to see, but it is certainly in the right direction. This is the general conclusion that we need more time to consult among ourselves.
The high-stake talks were aimed at forging a deal to freeze oil production. Russia's energy minister, Alexander Novak, blamed Saudi Arabia and its Persian Gulf allies for the talks' failure.
You know that we had a long discussion today. This was due to some OPEC members changing their stances in the morning right before our meeting by proposing that this agreement should be implemented under the condition of participation with all OPEC members, as well as large oil exporters that are not members of OPEC. This was Saudi Arabia and a number of OPEC members, including the UAE and Qatar. Mostly these were states of the Persian Gulf.
Iran did not participate in the meeting, saying it would not freeze its production rate until it reaches the pre-sanctions level. but Tehran said it supports any measure to stabilize the volatile oil market. The next meeting on the issue is scheduled for June 5th and will take place in Vienna. Oil prices have been falling over the past 2 years, mainly due to Saudi Arabia's overproduction. Those low oil prices, coupled with fallen prices for raw commodities in general, have caused political instability in a number of producer countries, including Saudi Arabia, where some members of the royal family have openly called for the replacement of the current king. But among those hit particularly hard are a number of countries here in the Western Hemisphere, where economic fallout from the slowdown in revenues has been an important factor in the resurgence of right-wing politicians in Venezuela, Argentina, and Brazil, among others. In Venezuela, the reduction in revenue, coupled with economic warfare by the U.S. and the Venezuelan corporate elite against the population and the left-wing government, led to the election of a right-wing majority in the National Assembly. In Argentina, similar conditions led to the election of a right-wing president. And in Brazil, attempts to mitigate the loss of revenue to continue the government's ability to fund essential anti-poverty programs led to an ongoing attempt to impeach the leftist president, Dilma Rousseff. Those efforts moved forward this past weekend. Members of the lower house of Brazil's Congress voted Sunday to impeach President Dilma Rousseff in a fiercely contested ballot seeking to put an end to 13 years of leftist rule in the country. The process now moves to the Senate, who will vote on whether to approve or reject the proceedings. If the Senate approves an impeachment measure by a simple majority, President Rousseff would be required to temporarily step aside for 180 days while the Senate convenes a trial, and Vice President Michel Temer, a member of the right-wing opposition, would assume the presidency for the interim. If 2/3 or 54 senators should vote in favor of impeachment, Temer would serve out the remainder of President Rousseff's term, which ends in 2018. A former guerrilla fighter who was imprisoned and tortured after she took on Brazil's U.S.-backed military dictatorship, Dilma Rousseff began a rise that ultimately led her to the presidency, despite the fact that she's more activist than politician, as CCTV's Stephen Gibbs reports.
The country's first woman president, a former oil minister and chief of staff to her predecessor, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Lula, as he's known, had hand-picked her as his successor. He was the most popular president in Brazil's history, and millions of Brazilians were more than happy to follow his advice. And with the country's leftist Labour Party, Rousseff had credibility. She's a former guerrilla fighter who had been imprisoned and tortured in the 1960s during Brazil's military dictatorship. For most of the first 3 years of her presidency, Dilma Rousseff enjoyed relatively high popularity. The economy was growing, albeit slowly, and the government continued to lift millions of people out of poverty. Relations with the US were often strained, particularly when revelations emerged that Washington's National Security Agency had targeted Rousseff's mobile phone. Relations with China seemed stronger. China is Brazil's biggest trading partner, and Rousseff is a major proponent of the BRICS grouping of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. But domestically, things have been going less well for the president. In June 2013, widespread protests erupted across Brazil, not directly against Rousseff, but against generally poor public services and corrupt politicians. Rousseff went on national television to say she was listening to the protesters' concerns and even agreed with them. But the episode marked the beginning of a decline in her popularity.
One thing both Dilma Rousseff's friends and allies do concede is that the president is by no means a natural politician.
She doesn't have charisma. I mean, she's not like Lula. Lula has a great charisma, speaks very well in public, right? She doesn't have that. She does not communicate very well. She doesn't have charisma. She's like a technocratic, you know, type, you know, and that doesn't help her at all, I think.
Stephen Gibbs, CCTV, Rio de Janeiro.
After the vote, Brazil's Attorney General, José Eduardo Cardoza, pointed to the paradox that the president of the lower house of Congress Eduardo Cunha, is facing charges for corruption, yet Rousseff, who has not been accused of any criminal activity, is the one facing impeachment. Cardoza called the vote a purely political act that constituted, quote, a coup against the government of Rousseff, close quote. Rousseff's opposition members of Congress actually affirmed the Attorney General's accusation against them, with opposition member Eduardo Bolsonaro dedicating his yes vote on impeachment to the military that led the coup in 1964, which brought Brazil a bloody military dictatorship that lasted for 21 years. But some think the impunity that the right-wing opposition has displayed may backfire. According to Adi Spezi of the Popular Front of Brazil, the push to impeach Rousseff has actually had the effect of uniting the left in an effort to defend democracy. In the lead-up to the vote, hundreds of thousands of pro-democracy and anti-government demonstrators took to the streets, gathering in public areas to watch the vote live, with, at a national level, crowds supporting President Rousseff far outnumbering those calling for impeachment. For more on all of that, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We spoke with him Sunday via Skype, just before the vote to refer Rousseff's case out for impeachment to the Senate was announced.
In Brazil, what's going on at the moment, very dramatic events in the Brazilian legislature. I mean, there was a series of administrative moves. First, there was a report by a rapporteur appointed by the Brazilian legislature, the lower house of the Brazilian legislature. And his report, as was expected, and I think he's an opposition deputy in the Brazilian legislature, recommended that the impeachment process go ahead. Then that recommendation went to a commission of something like 60 deputies in the Legislative Assembly to consider whether it should then, the impeachment process should be put to a plenary session in the Assembly. And the astonishing thing about that commission is that, and I think I had 62 members, 36 of them, Don, are under investigation for corruption charges.
Yeah, what's interesting about that is with the Panama Papers, all but two of those in that grouping that voted in favor of moving the impeachment process forward had accounts or shell corporations listed in the Panama Papers.
I hadn't seen that. Thanks, all but two. Thanks for that. Okay. This goes back to what Pepe Escobar has been was writing about two or three weeks ago about the hollow men, he called them,
and they are
all men, and they're all completely corrupt. And so you have this extraordinary situation where the whole world is looking on at a process where even the Brazilian system itself acknowledges that these people are corrupt. If you look at the way the prosecution, public prosecutor's office is running these cases, and the way the judiciary is handling these cases, they're all kind of soft peddling the cases against the right wing, the corrupt individuals on the right wing, but then really going hard after anybody associated with the Workers' Party. And one of the curious things is that people acknowledge that neither Dilma Rousseff nor Lula da Silva are in any way involved in the Petrobras scandal.
Right.
But if you read coverage of the what's going on in Brazil, the implications and the insinuations and the innuendo is that, the reason that they're prosecuting President Rousseff, Dilma Rousseff, is because in some way, some ill-defined way, she's associated with the Petrobras scandal, and she's not.
Right.
And what's the case against her is, as we discussed last week, I think, is based on some administrative budgetary transactions.
Bookkeeping.
Yeah, and how did these transactions come to light? Because they were published.
Right.
The government, you know, the government.
What they did was they took this government asset and they didn't put it in their Swiss bank account like we're talking about with the right-wing people and with the people at the Petrobras scandal who are also of or associated with the right wing.
Yeah.
But rather, they took it from the Petrobras, the oil account, and put it in the account that they used to give food to people.
Yeah, their anti-poverty programs. And so, you know, that was that covered up? No, it wasn't covered up.
Right.
Did anybody personally benefit from it?
No.
No, nobody personally benefited from it.
Right.
So what is the impeachment process about? It's completely spurious.
Yep.
Because those kinds of administrative maneuvers were engaged in, they may not be entirely correct, but they were engaged in by governments, you know,
right,
for the previous two or three decades,
right,
to the arrival in power of Dilma Rousseff.
Yeah, you set up the books and you didn't have a column for feeding people.
Right.
So
right.
That's the real crime, is that there is such a column and that there's funds in it that should be in your pocket. That's the crime, isn't it?
Yeah, and particularly from the point of view of somebody like Eduardo de Cunha, who's this guy who's the president of the lower house of the Brazilian National Assembly, and as we've repeatedly explained in earlier programs, and this guy is somebody who has been caught red-handed with him and his family having Swiss bank accounts in which they've got enormous sums of money running into millions of dollars that they can't explain how they came by.
And they also have shell corporations in Panama.
Right, yeah. So there, the case then goes to the Senate, and there's another stage in the Senate where, again, the opposition, in theory, have a majority. Now, if you read the reports in Telesur, Prensa Latina, and media that attempt to give a true and fair account of what's going on, they're suggesting that the government shouldn't have any difficulty to prevent the impeachment vote going through. And then, but then if you read the right-wing media, oh, it's a, you know, Bloomberg, for example.
Yeah.
And if you read any of these kind of NATO country psychological warfare media, like The Guardian, New York Times, Washington Post, Bloomberg itself, or, you know, any of them, they'll all say what they're trying to do is to create a context in which it's a context of inevitability, if you like,
right,
so that, you know, it's just totally natural that there should be a vote for the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, and then if the vote does go against Dilma Rousseff, they can then pitch it as, well, yes, it was all a foregone conclusion anyway, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's how they'll put it. And if the vote goes against them, if Dilma Rousseff manages to get sufficient votes to prevent the impeachment process going forward, then they'll be able to pitch it as, oh, this incredible setback, an astonishing turnaround. Obviously, the Dilma Rousseff bought a load of deputies,
right,
just to reinforce the corruption message.
Right.
But what I find fascinating about it is that the whole system is corrupt. And I think Richard Salgado, among other people, I know one or two other people have been writing about this, and Telesur has been putting up some good articles about how corruption and anti-corruption is used as a motif to kind of cut the ground from under any progressive government or political movement that attempts to engage in social and economic change in Latin America and the Caribbean that is not to the liking of local right-wing elites and their backers in the US government and in the governments of the countries of the European Union. And what happens is there's a kind of symbiosis between the exploitation, the corrupt exploitation of the judicial powers in these countries and the massive corporate media power in these countries, in particular in Brazil. And, for example, when Dilma Rousseff attempted to try and put out a broadcast, putting her side of the story. The Big O Globo and other corporate media in Brazil just refused to broadcast what she had to say, so she had to put out a video. Right. And so what happens is that you find a you take the corrupt judiciary, and from that corrupt judiciary, you develop spurious accusations that have no basis in fact, but have to be dealt with. They become facts because they take on a legal life of their own.
They have no basis in law either, but they take on a legal life of their own.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So then. And then what then happens is that this massive corporate media machine takes those accusations and amplifies them and spreads them as broadly as they can, and so that they take on this kind of virtual reality. There's a kind of they become an overwhelming virtual reality.
Right.
And what that does is that it contributes to this sense of the inevitability of the process taking its course, and these people like Dilma Rousseff or Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner in Argentina becoming victims of this process and becoming politically discredited as a result. And that's why the representatives of the governments of the European Union and the representatives of the US government are constantly attacking. And the object of their attacks are media legislation in countries like Ecuador that were deliberately put onto the statute books by the Ecuadorian government in an attempt to break the corporate monopoly over news and information in this case in Ecuador. But that law was very much a development. It's something that was very popular in Ecuador, and it's something that has gone some way. It's difficult to gauge how successful it's been in breaking the corporate media monopoly in terms of the reach of these media to the population in Ecuador. But that's the reason why, for example, Mauricio Macri, when he came to power early in December,
at a Telesur
last year, and among his first measures was to attack the media law. Put on the statute book by Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her colleagues,
right.
in her second term as president, and that had the same objective as the media law in Ecuador, to democratize communications media in Argentina, and to break the corporate monopoly that has proved, for example, of La Nación and Clarín, these big media entities in private sector entities in Argentina. And it's those entities that were absolutely crucial in spreading the extremely deceitful and dishonest electoral campaign message of Mauricio Macri, and enabled him to squeeze in with a very narrow victory in the presidential elections in November last year.
Well, you remember, in the coup, for example, in Venezuela in 2002, one of the first things that they did was take out the only non-privately owned broadcasting center in the country. They took out the TV channel 8, I think it was, and it was only when they were able to regain that, when the loyalists to the revolutionary government took control of that and told people, okay, let's go, that they were able to undo the coup. I mean, that did not escape anyone's attention on either side.
Right. And again, people have probably forgotten this, but was it 2008, 2009, something like that? Hugo Chavez and his government they denied a license of the government's broadcasting authority denied a license to a company called RCTV, which had been one of the main channels in the coup in 2002.
Right.
And there was a massive outcry in the United States and in Europe from the supporters of the right-wing opposition in Venezuela,
right.
In those countries, claiming an attack on freedom of expression. And RCTV maintained its extensive cable facilities, and it was just denied the official broadcasting channel that they previously used to attack the government.
Right.
And so, you know, and it's not, and people still, back then, people were arguing, even back then, people were arguing that, you know, no freedom of expression in Venezuela. But even with the removal of that broadcasting channel from RCTV and its assignation to, I think it was assigned to community radios.
Right.
The Venezuelan media back then still had something like 60% control of Venezuela's communications media, and even back, you know, back then they were talking about a dictatorship, you know.
Right.
So, and it's all so false and spurious, isn't it? All these accusations.
Yeah.
So we looked a little bit at Brazil, and maybe we should look a bit at what's happened in Argentina.
Yeah, for sure.
So then in Argentina, last week, Cristina Fernandez appeared in front of a judge in Buenos Aires. And this judge, I think we also talked about this last week, this judge is attempting to bring a prosecution against Cristina Fernandez, the former head of the central bank under the second administration of Cristina Fernandez, and her young economy minister, Axel Kilisov. I think that's how you pronounce it. It might be Kilikov. But the charge is that, or the accusation is, because it's very ill-defined. It's not an extremely precise. They're not saying you did this and as a result you benefited in this way and that is a crime. It's not.
Right.
It's nothing like that.
Right.
And what they're saying is that in some vague sense, a routine transaction on the futures market, resulted in a drop in the value of the original transaction, which is essentially a bet on the future value,
right,
the future value of the dollar.
Right.
Because that bet didn't work out in a positive way, there was, in some vague sense, the Argentinian people, the Argentinian state, suffered some kind of ill-defined loss.
Right.
That's essentially the accusation.
It's a single transaction, right, or a single series of transactions, as opposed to a context where you have hedges betting on this side, betting on this side. Some of them lose, some of them win. Nobody's saying, here's the whole picture and the net.
Right. Well, what Cristina Fernandez did was, in her written presentation to the judge, and she explained very clearly that this transaction was actually a transaction that was designed to stabilize the value of the currency and prevent a de facto devaluation of the currency, and it worked. I don't understand the financial details of it, but her argument is that it was part of a series of transactions that have been carried out by the Argentinian government for many years, and apparently this judicial procedure was set in train during the election campaign. And what Macri and his team did was to allege that this particular futures transaction would cause a devaluation, would actually cause a devaluation, and then they used that to kind of smear the government as being financially incompetent.
Right.
And then when Macri won the campaign, what did he do? He instigated a massive devaluation
immediately
of the Argentine peso against the dollar. And that's what his policies led to. But during the campaign, he was claiming that this supposedly inappropriate financial futures bet by the government was going to bring about the result that he actually deliberately engineered once he got into the presidency.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.